appreciate very much Mr. Delamater's efforts in organizing the choir and selecting music, and certainly to our accompanists and all the choir members. Really adds a energy to the holy days to be able to join together and hear that and or participate in that. We heard this morning a sermon on, to a certain extent, on covenants. We will be looking at some similar territory this afternoon. God's Word has quite a bit to say about covenants. There are a number of covenants that we could make reference to. There are covenants between equals, if you will. Now, we know that in the family, God has placed a certain hierarchy, but in the spiritual sense, you know, we men and women are equals, and when we join in a marriage covenant before God, that's one type of covenant. There are covenants between God and an individual. And, of course, we are familiar and have heard again rehearsed today, to a certain extent, covenant between God and ancient Israel, or between God and any group of people, such as this group that's assembled here together. And whether you have already made a decision to enter a covenant in which God is a part, be that a marriage, be that baptism, or whether you are at the stage of life where you are considering one of those major commitments, it's instructive to know how God feels about commitments, how God views these covenants, these contracts, if you will. And we need to recognize the critical importance of keeping covenant with God. And so I've given this message the title, Keeping Covenant with God, because as we've already heard said a couple of different ways today, there is no more important issue in whether you will make it into God's kingdom, whether I will make it into God's kingdom, whether you've already made that commitment, whether you have yet to make that commitment and will most likely do so at a later date. There is no greater issue than keeping covenant with God. Turn with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Again, a covenant, a contract, a vow are, if not synonyms, they're quite close in their meaning and in their application. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and verse 4, it says, we are told here that when you vow a vow, verse 4, when you vow a vow to God, to the Eternal, do not hold back from paying it. For he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. And again, a vow was a type of contract. A vow is, if we state that we will do something, if we state that to God, it's a contract. Verse 5, we read, it is better to not vow than to vow and then not pay up. Our word should have the binding strength of a vow, of a pledge, of an oath. Our word should have, again, that effect on us, that when we give our word to another person, to God, that we feel duty-bound to keep our word. In verse 2, it says, do not allow your mouth to cause you to sin. It says you won't be able to just say later on, oh, I made a mistake. It was my bad. That won't pass muster. It says, why should the Eternal be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? And in verse 2, again, it says, do not be rash with your mouth. We're not supposed to jump into things blindly. we know that we're told to consider, to be careful, to think through decisions that we make. If you've bought a house, you probably didn't see it, and 10 minutes later you were signing the papers, okay, this is the perfect house for me. No, you probably went through and you had somebody inspect it, you had the plumbing, you had the foundation, you had the wood checked. Entering into a marriage covenant contract. Again, it's not, oftentimes a snap decision in that is not a great decision. Oftentimes, well, I'm sure we've all heard stories of somebody who, you know, fell in love at first sight and things worked out marvelously because they were both committed. But in general, it's good to think things through. Think things through. Think it over before you sign your name. Again, verse 2, it says, do not be rash in speech, and do not let your heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is way up there and we're way down here, and He's going to remember what we've said to Him. He is all-powerful. We need to remember our place. Therefore, it says, let your words be few. So again, we're told to think things over. We're told to consider, to weigh. And for those of us who have entered into marriage or who have entered into baptism, most of us did just that. We gave it a lot of thought. I heard the phrase case studies today. We'll be looking at a couple of case studies. Let's turn to Judges chapter 11. We'll take a look at a positive case study, if you will. This individual has sort of been, it's been pondered as to whether he was a positive case study or not, but I think that the record bears out that he indeed was. In Judges 11, we get introduced to Jephthah, the Gileadite. He says he was a mighty man of valor. He's one of the top men in the army, and he was going to be going into battle, or he was charged with certain military exercises. In verse 30, it says, Jephthah vowed a vow to the Eternal. So, he probably gave this some thought. He probably knew that the odds were not good and that he certainly needed the help of the Eternal. He vowed a vow and said, if you shall without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that whatsoever comes forth from the gates of my house to meet me when I return in peace from this battle will be dedicated to the Lord, to the Eternal. And if it is a suitable thing, I will offer it as a burnt offering. If a donkey would have come out to meet him, he wouldn't have offered it up as a burnt offering because donkeys were not suitable burnt offerings. Nor, of course, are a great number of other things, including humans. So what do we see? We see a man who made a vow. He said, I'm going to go fight this battle, but I know that the victory is yours to give. I'm making a vow that if you allow me to return in health and in peace, safely from this battle, that I will do such and such and such. And in verse 35, well, it says that in verse 34, as he was coming home, his daughter came out to meet him. And she was rejoicing and she was happy that he had come home safely. And in verse 35 it says, it came to pass that when he saw her, he was of course very emotional because here he was going to have to give his daughter to the temple service to go be one of the women who served at the temple. And her life would be devoted in that sense to serving God. And he says, alas, my daughter, you brought me very low. You know, you've brought me trouble. And he told his daughter, for I have opened my mouth to the Eternal, and I cannot go back. How many people do you think there were in ancient Israel who made vows to God? Maybe they were rash vows. Oh, if you'll just save me, I will do this or that. And then went back on them. And then simply said, well, oops, I didn't see that coming. Never mind. I didn't mean to say that. Jephthah could have been just another disappointment to God. Well, I promised you this, God, but didn't know it was going to work out this way. He could have just been another person who made a vow and then disappointed. And we would have never heard about him. He wouldn't have been recorded. His story is recorded because he did the hard thing. We heard about the good times and the bad times. Well, this was a kind of a bad time. Wow, my daughter came out, and that means she's not going to bear me any children. In verse 34, I skipped over a little bit in the second half of verse 34, but we read here that beside this one daughter, he had no other son or daughter. He had made a vow, and in order to keep that vow, he was going to have his line extinguished. His line, his name, that branch in the family tree ended right there. But just like you and I are faced with choices, are we going to do the hard thing? Are we going to stick with commitments that we make when they're harder than we thought they might be? Jephthah chose to allow his physical lineage to end, but God chose to honor him and to remember him and to record this story as an example to you and I, again, a case study, if you will, of this is what I'm looking for. Not just, okay, yeah, great, we're getting manna every day, sure, I'll follow you, God, but okay, now where's the water, or where's these other things that I think I need? Are we still going to follow God? Jephthah honored God by keeping his vow, and God in turn honored him. Let's turn to Psalm chapter 15, because in this psalm, it's a brief psalm, a powerful psalm, King David speaks regarding the traits of godly character. Here's what godly character looks like. Here's the sort of person that brings a smile to God's face. Here's the sort of things that God's looking for when he's making up his list of names in the book of life. In Psalm chapter 15 and verse 1, it says, Lord, who shall dwell? Who shall live in your house? Who shall dwell on the holy hill? He who walks uprightly, he who works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. Again, Jephthah, what he spoke, he made sure that it was true by following up, by backing up his words with actions. He who that does not backbite with his tongue, nor does any harm to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his neighbor. So we see these characteristics of a righteous individual. In the second half of verse 4, it says, he or she, God looks to one who swears to his own hurt and doesn't back out on it, doesn't try to back out on it. Jephthah made a vow. Wow, that vow is going to cost me a lot more than I thought it was. But I gave my word. He who keeps his word, even though it costs more than he had anticipated. And it says at the end of verse 5, he that does these things shall never be moved. Shall never be moved. And it reminded me a lot of the verse in Revelation 3, verse 12, that says, him will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will go no more out. He that does these things shall never be moved. There's a character there that God can work with. There's a person there that God can give authority and power to and trust that this individual will stay true to God, because he stayed true when it really cost him. In Luke chapter 14, I made reference to this earlier. It's a verse that we oftentimes turn to in the Passover season and when we're contemplating baptism or if you've counseled for baptism, you've looked at Luke chapter 14 and verse 28. We read, for which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? We're supposed to be knowing our character. We're supposed to be examining ourselves. We're supposed to know, do I really have the intestinal fortitude to, if I make this promise, do I really have what it takes to push myself to keep my word? We're supposed to be asking God to show us our heart, our core. Do I really have what it takes? And then we discover the answer, and then we proceed from there with making a decision. How careful are we to count the cost? Will we stick to our contract no matter what comes? Again, we heard this morning, yeah, there's good, yeah, there's bad, there's blessings, there's sickness, there's injury, there's great times, there's sad times. There's good and bad in this growth process. Have we thought through what we will have to give up? And I know many of us have already entered into these covenants of marriage and of baptism, and we know that we get so much more than what we might have given up. What we've given up is a pale nothing compared to the joys that can be had in marriage and the joys that there are in following God. But still, we're told to ponder these things. And even those of us who've already made these commitments, are we still thinking ahead of, okay, Father, I know that there will be hard times coming because it happens to all of us. Please help me to be strong, to stand firm. There's a brief account in Acts chapter 23, and I just basically want to point out one of the words there. In Acts chapter 23, we read about a vow that was taken. And this same phraseology is used in a number of cases with vows or with oaths. In Acts chapter 23 and verse 21, it says, "Do not yield to these men, for there are some who lie in wait." So there was some people who had made a vow. It says, "There's more than 40 men who have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat nor drink until they have killed Paul here. And now they are ready," and they're... So we read about a vow, but the wording of they have bound themselves with an oath. And back in the Old Testament, where it's talking about if a daughter vows a vow and binds herself with an oath, then her father, when he hears it, can either ratify it by doing nothing or he can annul it. But that phraseology of being bound with an oath brings to mind the phrase, you know, my hands are tied. My hands are tied. When Jephthah had made that vow, he said, you know, my daughter, I'd love for you to have children and a husband and that sort of joy, but my hands are tied. Nothing I can do about it. Now, we know that he could have. We know it was 100% his choice, but because his mind was set on following God, his hands were tied. So this whole idea of binding, being bound by an oath, again, that's something that we can sort of wrap our minds around. We're going to take a detailed look at one particular oath that was made. And so we're going to get a little bit of a backstory here to it. Let's turn, please, to 2 Samuel chapter 16. As I was reading through this part of Scripture recently, as we go through the Bible for this calendar year, just struck by some similarities, some comparisons here. And this story, I think, has quite a bit that we can learn. So in 2 Samuel 16 and verse 5, here David, his son Absalom, has gathered together forces and allies and backers, and he's taken over the throne. He's taken over the country. David is fleeing. In chapter 16, verse 5, it says that when King David came to Bahurim, behold, there came out a man from the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came forth and he cursed still as he came. He was not happy that King David had taken over from King Saul. In verse 7 it says, "Thus said Shimei when he cursed, 'Come out, come out.'" In other words, like he's like saying, "Yeah, that's right, get out of Israel. You have no business here." He says, "Come out, come out, you bloody man, you man who have taken lives." He blamed King David for Saul's house having lost the kingdom. And he says, "You man of Belial, you just completely wicked, worthless man." He was calling him a bloodthirsty savage. And I won't go over that part of the story, but we can see how King David acted in the presence of this. He took it, he suffered it, and he said, "Well, perhaps God will repay me with kindness because of this cursing that I'm enduring that is not really fair." But he took it, and he wouldn't allow his men to go in and cut down Shimei. And it's not, and in verse 13 it says, "And David and his men went by the way, Shimei went along the hillside." So they were probably walking down here, and Shimei was up on the top of the hill, and he was throwing dust and dirt and stones at them. So he saw this as, well, this is what David deserves. This is God punishing him for what he did to the house of Saul. Now, we don't have to turn to Exodus 22 and verse 28, but back in Exodus 22 and verse 28, we are warned that you should not curse the ruler of your people. You shall not curse the ruler of your people. And that's exactly, of course, what Shimei was guilty of right here. And as I ponder that, it reminds me of how some of us in talking about this politician or that politician can sometimes be overly negative and overly critical and sort of allow ourselves to get too attached and involved into some of these controversies. We know full well that there are no righteous politicians and there are no righteous leaders. That's just not the situation we have. And God didn't put us here to sort of be part of the ruckus of just complaining about it, because we could complain until we got really, really tired, because there's no end of things that need fixing. But we know that we look towards God's kingdom for those fixes. We should not curse the ruler of our people. Now, we're going to see a couple of similarities between Shimei and King David. Let's turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 24, rather. 1 Samuel 24 and verse 3. Because never mind, you shall not curse the ruler of your people. King David had the chance to take matters into his own hands on more than one occasion. And we read about one of those here in 1 Samuel 24 and verse 3. It says that Saul was going through the land, and he came near a place where there was a cave, and he went in there to use it as a latrine. And David and his men were hiding in the recesses of the cave. So here was David's chance. Here was David's chance. He had been anointed. He had been told he'd be king. Here was his chance. Verse 4, "The men of David said to him, 'Behold, hey, look at this. God promised you. Here's your adversary. Let's do what we ought to do. Behold, the day of which the Eternal said unto you, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.'" So he had his own men urging him to take matters into his own hands. And we know that he snuck forward and he cut off the hem or the back portion of Saul's robe. And he said to his men, verse 6, "The Eternal forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, because he is the anointed of the Eternal. Therefore I cannot stretch forth my hand against him, seeing that that's who he is." It wasn't his loyalty to Saul that didn't permit him to act. It was his loyalty to God. It was his loyalty to the fact that, no, God told me it's going to happen. I don't have to make it happen. It'll happen because God said that, and I can wait on God. In verse 5, it came to pass after this that David's heart, his conscience really kicked in. His conscience really bothered him about this incident because he had cut off part of Saul's robe. Even this little thing, this little show of disrespect, if you will. You're not supposed to come up to the king. You're not supposed to sneak up on the king, certainly. You're not supposed to assault in any way his person. Those are all small aspects of that command in Exodus chapter 22 of you shall not curse the ruler of your people. Those are all little aspects of that. Even this small trespass seemed to David's conscience to be a sin. And so his conscience bothered him. And so now we're back with Shimei, and now David, the anointed of the Eternal, just as he referred to Saul, David is being assailed and he's being denied the respect due to the office that he had been placed into. Go back to 2 Samuel and we'll turn to chapter 19, pick up the story a little bit later. So we see again King David as an example of being patient, waiting for God, right? If God will exalt his people in due time, we read. And David was not going to preempt God. David was not going to say, well, I guess this is the time, this is the opportunity, and jump on it. And in 2 Samuel 19 and verse 16, again, Shimei. So, the tables have turned. And David is now returning to Jerusalem. He now has been summoned back to be crowned, to be re-welcomed as the king. And in verse 16 it says that Shimei, again, hastened and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. So Shimei ran. He wanted to be one of the first ones to greet King David. He wanted to put out that anger. He knew that David was not likely to have forgotten the slight done to him, the disrespect given to him. And so he's coming to seek to sort of quench, to throw some water on that fire. And in verse 19, he said to the king, do not let my lord the king impute iniquity unto me, neither remember that which your servant did perversely on the day which my lord the king went out of Jerusalem, that the king should take it to his heart. So he's saying, please just... And it's very reminiscent of part of David's prayer in Psalm chapter 51 and verse 9. In Psalm 51 and verse 9, you don't have to turn there, I'll just... He says, blot out my iniquity and hide my sin from your view. In my mind, I hear the words of the hymn rather than the words of the King James, but... Blot out my iniquity. These are the exact same thoughts, the exact same feelings that Shimei is expressing here. And in verse 20, he said, for your servant, I, Shimei, know that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I am come the first this day of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king. He says, I'm trying to make amends. And again in Psalm chapter 51, verse 3, David said, I acknowledge my sin and it's ever before me. I acknowledge my transgressions and my sin is ever before me. It's very reminiscent of what Shimei was saying to him. Again, it was sort of interesting to see some of these parallels because David is on the receiving end at one point and he's at the beseeching for mercy end, and he's also being besought for mercy at the other side. And in verse 23, it says, the king, because of all these things, said unto Shimei, you shall not die. And the king, made an oath unto him. And that's reminiscent of when Nathan said to King David back in this time of this incident, he says, God has put away your sin. You shall not die. When David acknowledged his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah, and when he repented and chose the proper attitude? Nathan told him, God has put away your sin. You shall not die. And so again, that had been told to David at that time. And here he's basically giving that same message of lenience here to Shimei. You and I have crimes, have sins that we've committed. Some of us have been baptized. Some of us have not yet been baptized. God offers that pardon. But it requires constant, concerted commitment. Let's turn to another verse on this topic. Because in 1 Kings chapter 2, King David is now old. And he's telling Solomon, don't forget about that guy, Shimei. In 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse 8, he says to his son, behold, you have with you Shimei, who cursed me with grievous cursing in the day when I went to Mahanaim. But he came down to meet me at the Jordan, and I swore to him by the Eternal, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. Nonetheless, verse 9, do not hold him guiltless. And so King David is sort of, I guess, warning Solomon of some of the people in the land who need watching, need attention. And then we get down to an oath in verse 36. We get down to this oath that we're looking at. I'm going to talk for a little bit about. In verse 36 of 1 Kings chapter 2, it says that King Solomon sent and called for Shimei and said unto him, build for yourself a house in Jerusalem and live in it and do not any more go outside this city of Jerusalem. Do not go anywhere outside the city of Jerusalem. Verse 37, for it shall be that on the day that you go out and pass over the brook Kidron, you shall know for certain that you shall surely die. Your blood will be upon your own head. And this sounds more like an edict of a king rather than a covenant or an agreement. And yet we'll find out that it is just that. It is a contract, a covenant. It is an example of what's known as a suzerain covenant. And I'd like to just read a couple of paragraphs about this sort of covenant. In the ancient Near East, treaties between kings were common. Again, treaties between equals. Like if you and I were to enter a business deal, a treaty among equals. Or treaties between kings were common. These were treaties drawn up among equals and mostly outlined agreements to honor each other's boundaries, to maintain trade relations, to return runaway slaves. So when the king of Israel took the daughter of the king of Egypt in marriage or king of some other country in marriage, it was to, again, ratify an agreement such as this. It says, we also have in records treaties that were drafted between a superior and an inferior. Somebody with some stature and some pull and some influence and some authority and somebody less so. If the relationship was familial or friendly, the parties are referred to as father and son. If the relationship is bereft of kindness and intimacy, the parties are referred to as lord and servant, or king and vassal, or in some cases a greater king and a lesser king, because you could have a town of very small environs, and if you were the leader of that town, you were the king, but somebody over there might have much bigger territory. So you'd have a lesser king and a greater king. The greater king is the suzerain, and the lesser king is a prince, or a lesser lord in the service of the greater king. The lesser lord is a representative of all the common people who are under the protection of the greater king, and he would then enforce the treaty with the people over whom he had authority. These suzerain and vassal treaties open with two sections. First, they identify the higher authority. So we have King Solomon clearly, I mean, they're having this meeting in Solomon's court. His authority is easily seen. the identifying of the suzerain by his names and titles. Secondly, the historical survey of the suzerain's dealings with the vassal. In other words, he rehearsed with Shimei, here's what you did. Here's the dealings we've had in the past. Now, when God calls us, he begins to show us what he knows about us. He begins to show us, here's a couple of things that you need to work on. And when you've worked on those, we'll talk some more, almost. He doesn't show us, here's 50,000 things you need to fix. He gives us a couple, and if we respond with faith and with trust and in working to allow him to mold and shape us, then he shows us more. But again, he knows us. The purpose, it says, of this part of the contract is to illustrate to the vassal how much the suzerain has done to protect and establish the vassal, who therefore owes submission and allegiance to, again, that the greater king. And of course, we all know that we have been given everything we have by God. Every opportunity for us to enjoy life, every opportunity for us to have opportunities to serve, to grow, to enjoy, are all gifts that have been given to us, and we owe submission and we owe allegiance to God. The next section of these treaties, it says, lists the stipulations. So we just read a stipulation. You're going to build a house in Jerusalem. You're going to stay in there. You're going to stay within the confines of Jerusalem. You're going to stay on this side of the brook Kidron. That's your stipulations. You and I get stipulations. You need to learn my laws. You need to not just learn them to be able to quote them. You need to learn them to do them. You need to let me... God says, you need to let me crawl inside your mind and heart and change them and mold them to create holy, righteous character, something that only God can produce. Stipulations. What the vassal is required to do is spelled out in principle and in detail. This section is often concluded with the requirement that the vassal deposit his copy of the treaty in his temple, where he is to occasionally read and study it to refresh his memory concerning his duties. Well, we have some stipulations, and we are told to occasionally read and study to refresh ourselves on what are our duties, what are our stipulations that God's given us, what's expected of us, what's required of us. The last section of these treaties, it said, contains the blessings and the curses of the suzerain. If the stipulations are met by the vassal, he will receive the suzerain's blessings. So, of course, in this story here in 1 Kings, we say, okay, your blessing is you're going to get to stay alive. If you do this and that, you will be allowed to live as a free man. Just like in a city of refuge. If you came to a city of refuge and if you were not found worthy of being handed over to the avenger of blood, you were entitled to live as a comfortable life in that city of refuge. But you better not leave until the death of the high priest. And you and I, of course, we've got blessings that we can't even quite fathom entirely. We don't know what eternal life is going to be like. We don't know what it's going to be like to serve in God's presence. But we are invited. We're given glimpses. We are allowed to meditate on the thought to reinforce in our own minds the need to keep up our end of the bargain, to uphold our end of the contract. If the vassal fails to meet the stipulations, he will receive the curses of the suzerain, which are also listed. On the day that you cross over that brook, know that you will surely die. If you do not endure to the end, know that that promise of eternal life isn't going to come to us. We must fulfill our end of the covenant. And we just have one other brief paragraph here about this. It says the suzerain, or the higher person in this deal, would keep one copy of the treaty, and the vassal would keep one copy of the treaty. A number of ratifying ceremonies were used, depending on the era and the culture. But the most widely used rite was that of cutting the bodies of animals in two. We could read about that in the Old Testament. And placing them in two rows where you would walk in between these halves of these animals. As they walked between the pieces, they were vowing to each other, "May what has happened to these animals happen to me if I break this covenant with you." It was the idea of the phrase cutting a covenant, man, meant, okay, we're cutting these animals and we're going to walk through here to say, you know, like we can read in several places, "May the Lord do so to me and more also if I fail to keep this covenant." So back in 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse 38, again, as we read the verses earlier, it sounded more like, well, here's what you got to do. That's all there is to it. But we read in verse 38 that Shimei said unto the king, "The saying is good. As my master, the king has said, so will your servant do." So he signed his name, or he shook his hand, or he ratified the deal. And at that point, his life was his. His life wasn't in danger. When you and I got baptized, when you or I get baptized, our payment is covered. We're no longer under that death penalty. But of course, we have stipulations. We still have to keep up our end of the bargain. Shimei agreed to the terms of the covenant. He was now bound by all of its conditions. And so when we enter into one of these covenants, whether it's baptism or marriage, we, just like Shimei, are making a solemn vow, a solemn commitment. Both of these covenants offer, like I mentioned, fantastic rewards. But both carry a steep price for failure to live up to the agreement. A steep price. Now, you and I, who are baptized, recently went through the Passover service. We observed the sort of renewal, if you will, of that contract, the renewal of that agreement that we entered into. Some others, not yet baptized, took the opportunity to observe, to watch this memorial of the sacrifice of Jesus the Christ, as they count the cost for themselves. We always have some newer people in the church who are thinking about baptism, some younger people who are thinking about baptism. You need to be doing that, counting the cost. Okay, here's what I hear, here's what I see, here's what I read. Count the cost for yourself. This past week, we've all been probably giving some thought as we roam around this world on our missions, going to work or school or out. We've pondered the difficulty of avoiding leaven. Of course, leaven for this week, and not before the week and not after the week, but for these 7 days, it pictures sin. And the prevalence of sin and the difficulty of avoiding sin. I happen to have been out a lot, out and about a lot this past week. Usually I just go from home to school to home to school to... But I'm sort of out and about quite a bit this week and just having to constantly, okay, I got to focus my brain. I'm driving up to a place to get some kind of fast food, okay. You know, telling myself in the morning, don't forget, don't forget, don't forget, don't forget. As we try to make sure that when somebody tells us they accidentally ate some leaven, we can say, "Ha! I didn't." Because we know that makes us perfect, right? If we didn't. No, but we care. We want to please God. We don't want to slip in this way. I showed up at one place and I walked in and they're serving a buffet meal and it's breakfast time and I walk in and okay, the first hot item is French toast. Okay. Second item, pancakes. Third item, pork sausage patties. Oh. So I had to eat healthy stuff. Yeah. I had to take some fruit from the cold end of the aisle. Went in for dinner that night. Chicken tenders, breaded chicken. Just has to be. We have to be on our toes. This time of the feast is a time when we're not going to be struck down if we accidentally took a bite of a hamburger or ate the whole hamburger and realized later. It's a time to learn lessons. It's a time to learn lessons that sin is so prevalent, just like leaven is all around us, and that it's difficult to avoid unless we're really focused on what is our job description. Finishing off this story with Shimei, reading a couple more verses. So we're still in 1 Kings chapter 2, and in verse 39, it says, "It came to pass at the end of 3 years that two of the servants of Shimei ran away to Achish, son of the king of Gath. And it was told to Shimei, saying, 'Behold, your servants who ran away, I know where they are. They're in Gath.'" How many times has somebody left the church and we wondered, what were they thinking? Why did that person leave? How could Shimei forget what was at stake here? In verse 40, we see that he arose, he saddled his mule, he went to Gath, to Achish, to look for his servants. And he went and he got them and he brought them back. He traded what for what? Have you ever thought of our brothers and sisters who left and you say they traded what for what? What could they have been thinking? What could Shimei have been thinking? How could he forget that his life was at stake? Did he fail to count the cost? Did he perhaps think that his failure to uphold his end of the deal would go unnoticed? Well, maybe David won't. I mean, maybe Solomon, rather, won't find out. Verse 41. "It was told to Solomon that Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath and had returned." Would be pretty foolish to think that the wisest king ever to have lived, or the most powerful man in the place, is not going to notice when that you've gone to Gath. He probably had people assigned to keep an eye on Shimei, because his father had charged him, basically, you make sure he toes the line, or you get him. How much more foolish would it be for me, or for you, to think that, well, if I just have a little lapse, he's not going to notice. I can probably get away with that. And in verse 42 through 46, we see that he was called on the carpet by Solomon and he lost his life. Because that was the deal. Justice will be done. God is all about justice. Happily for us, he's also all about mercy and love. Justice requires a death penalty. Well, yes, it does. But he, in his love, allowed a substitute payment to be made on your behalf and mine. Let's turn to one last scripture here as we finish. There's a lot that we can learn by this repeatedly going through the scriptures, reading it year after year. Because God is God, and God can put more in here than we can absorb in 1 year. God can put more in here than we can absorb in a lifetime, because he opens our eyes as we strain for it and ask for the insight and help. He opens our eyes, and he feeds us with that spiritual bread, that unleavened bread. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse 8, it says, "For he who sows to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption." Just rot in the grave, And what did we see with Shimei? Whatever he had, he must have had several servants and this and that. And he, for the sake of whatever small pittance two new servants would have cost him, he gave away his life. He was chasing after that little bit. I don't want to let anything get away. Continuing in verse 8, it says, "But he who sows to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap everlasting life." So there's a payoff one way or the other. Which payoff are we going to choose? Which will we choose? Will we choose to honor the covenants that we've made with God? Will we choose to go chase our little bit of nothing, our two servants, at the cost of our own life? Or some other thing at the cost of our own life? As I was thinking about Shimei, I was reminded of something that always sort of boggled my mind in Revelation 20 and verse 8. Because just like Shimei made this completely nonsensical decision in Revelation 20 and verse 8, we read about there will be innumerable people who will follow Satan in his rebellion when he's loosed for a short season. And I've pondered, you know, what can we be doing? How can we be trying to teach others and reinforce God's teaching with others during the years of that time and during these years now, so that number can be brought as small as possible? We need to be strengthening one another. We need to be encouraging one another so that we can keep that number of people who, for some reason, despite everything God's done for them, will choose to side with the adversary. Makes no sense, but it's prophesied, therefore it's going to happen, and there's going to be a great many of them. You and I need to be smart on that. We need to be sticking close to God. As it says in Luke chapter 12 and verse 32, it's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom of God. But in order for you and I to be there, we need to be sure that we are keeping covenant with Him.